Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Jones versus Valadez.
May I please report, Daryl Smith, an argument from petitioners. Petitioners deserve 5 minutes
for rebuttal. Please court. Thank you for allowing us the privilege of being here. This is a tort case which raises concepts of qualified immunity of a peace officer against theories of assault and false imprisonment, negligence, gross negligence. There was no 42 U.S.C. 1983 claim. I submit the key issue is the significance of the officer's subjective state of mind as a criteria for qualified immunity or quasi-judicial immunity or official immunity. That term is usually loosely interchangeable. Concerning liability from suit and concerning immunity from liability in suit when the officer is in the process of implementing a warrantless arrest. The secondary issues, if we don't prevail on the first issue, would be the preservation of error and the completeness of an appellate record. The facts generally are that on November 28, 1988, in San Antonio, there was a fire in the early morning area hours of a church, at a church. The respondent was an overnight photographer for a television station. The petitioner was a San Antonio policeman. Both of them arrived at the fire to perform their respective jobs. The petitioner encountered the respondent among the firefighting equipment inside a fenced area and directed him to move. Later, there was an arrest. A suit was filed for assault, false imprisonment. It was amended later for allegations of negligence. The petitioner asserted his immunity from suit and liability and alleged that respondent had been also negligent in causing any damages he might have suffered. The case was tried to a jury on May the 2nd of 1991. 10 of the jurors found both of them were negligent. Also found that the petitioner assaulted the cameraman, falsely imprisoned him, and had been grossly negligent. The respondent moved for judgment on the verdict, and the petitioner timely filed a motion under Rule 301. Among other things, the petitioner called the trial court's attention to the immateriality of the jury finding on the intentional tort due to the officer's probable cause to arrest the respondent. After several settings, 6 months later, the trial court signed a judgment in favor of the respondent for negligence and negligent acts or omissions arising from the course and scope of employment with the City of San Antonio. The judgment was silent as to the intentional torts, and it awarded punitive damages. The immunity from suit or liability as a matter of law is what we are urging in our first point before the court. And the court was dealing with, at the trial court, a conjunctive submission of the elements of that immunity defense. That is, the essentially it was on the occasion of question, do you find preponderance of the evidence that the officer was acting in the course and scope of his authority and was performing discretionary functions and was acting in good faith? 10 of the jurors answered no. The Court of Appeals conceded, as had the trial court, that the petitioner conclusively proved that he was acting in the course and scope. The Court of Appeals further disregarded another portion of that jury's finding and found that the petitioner was performing discretionary functions. And then the court held that the issue of good faith was a fact issue and affirmed.
Is it subjective?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's exactly what it is. And I'm keying
on. So if it's subjective, how can a court ever say, as a matter of law, you conclusively establish good faith?
Well, perhaps I misunderstood your question. What I was taking off on was, and maybe I was anticipating too much, was a concurring opinion in the City of Deceit case where this court proposed that a valid way of looking at it might be objective and subjective criteria. And as I recall, the way the court analyzed in that opinion, it was one or the other. In this case, the subjective state of the officer's mind shouldn't come into play because of the other criteria, and that is, would a reasonable police officer under the same or similar circumstances have implemented the arrest? And we say, yes, he would have implemented the arrest because not only was there judicial admissions as to each element of the offenses of blocking a passageway and a subsequent judicial admission of the elements of the offense of failure to identify, but I guess in response to your question is that the court would look at one of those two and say in this case an officer, if you'll pardon me, with an attitude can still make a valid arrest. The hypothetical being something like if an officer were to go to someone's house with the idea that he was going to want to harass him, and before he was able to implement the harassing of that person, the person committed a felony in the officer's presence, that wouldn't make that arrest a bad arrest. And the subjective state of mind at that point would not be given the weight of the objective circumstance the officer encountered.
So as long as the officer, if there was probable cause to make the arrest, we wouldn't get to the issue of the officer's good faith, because even an officer with an attitude can make a valid arrest. But if where there's no probable cause for the arrest, do we then look at the subjective state of mind of the officer to determine whether he did so in good faith or merely was a rogue officer?
Well, the court has stated it far better than I have. Yes, sir. I think that would be exactly what would happen. I think the court would look at the state of mind if there were not probable cause for the arrest. I think what we've got here is probable cause established as a matter of law because of the duty imposed under the penal code and the code of criminal procedure upon our law enforcement officers to encounter crime and to implement arrests, even warrantless arrests, which are justified under the circumstances.
Counsel, as I understand it, this incident took place within an area that's cordoned off around the fire.
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And under that circumstance, what law enforcement officer is in charge of that cordoned off area?
Well, Your Honor, that's not clearly in the record, and that's certainly not clear in my mind. And I'm
well, as a matter, isn't it, though, at a fire that the fire chief is in charge of that area?
I don't know that to be the law, Your Honor.
In this instance, though, did the photographer have the permission of the fire chief to be in that area?
Well, what you're getting at, Your Honor, is the reasonableness of the officer's order to move back, I think. And yes, the fire chief certainly had the power to give him permission to come in, and that's not disputed. I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that we as citizens going into a fire scene shouldn't be allowed to second guess a certified peace officer who comes and asks us to move back by saying, first officer, may we go through the chain of command, or I had permission to be here earlier, because the changing circumstances might be such at a fire scene that a subsequent order to move back would be a valid, would be a reasonable request to move back, and would be in keeping with the law. So I don't think a carte blanche permission by a deputy fire chief to come in extends in perpetuity, if I understand the court's question. And I don't think that the officer exercising his discretion, who's not aware of that permission being granted by some, it could even be by a fellow officer, it could even be by a subordinate officer under different hypotheticals. The officer shouldn't be required to pull all of the potential sources of permission when you've got 10 to 12 trucks and the attendant number of fire people who are there saying, yes, it's okay to come in. In the course of battling that fire, it can change. The person might not initially be in the way of the firefighting, and later on, as the equipment and the men move around, it might develop that in the officer's judgment, he were.
In the points of error that you have presented to this court, you have drawn our attention to the issue of good faith.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your feeling that we must resolve that issue in this case?
I'm hopeful that this court will rule that as a matter of law, Officer Jones was in good faith by virtue of the duties that were, I'm sorry.
No, excuse me, I didn't mean to cut you off. Are you?
By the duties that were imposed upon him. But if not, then, Your Honor, what I would ask the court to do is consider sending it back for a fact determination out of the jury rather than out of the Court of Appeals or out of the trial court.
And for us to do either of those things, I suppose that it is necessary to have the court state clearly what good faith is.
Your Honor, it would be most helpful to those of us who are litigating these kinds of claims that qualified immunity and its requisite three prongs were to be defined by this court. There is some appellate court variation, and there's some discussion. I don't mean to suggest what you might want to get to, but concepts like individual and official capacity seem kind of vague some of the opinions too.
What I wanted to get to was the most recent writing in this court that you've already alluded to on that subject, the concurrence authored by Justice Cornyn. Do you agree that good faith includes both a subjective and an objective element?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions?
With regard to good faith, the court has had, as you know, tremendous difficulty in defining what good faith is in the discovery context. We've said what good faith is not in certain fact situations, but the court has been frustrated by our inability to say what good faith is in that context. Can you offer any suggestions to the court if we were to take your suggestion to try to clarify this area?
I wouldn't presume to on discovery, Your Honor. On this matter, I think it's pretty well limited to the duties imposed on the officer by law.
With regards to the issue of the statute that gives that you're hanging your hat on.
Yes, sir.
How do the other courts, the other states, treat this issue?
Of the reasonableness?
And when you have a mix of, when you have a probable cause to make an arrest?
I've relied a lot on federal citations in the brief. And,
have you done an all state search to determine how the other states deal with it?
No, I've just tried for the federal courts that would be in the same jurisdiction. I would suggest to the court also that it might be helpful if we get some kind of preference between our state courts, ideas on good faith and qualified immunity and those of the federal court, just because the officers out there are facing the possibility of two standards on the same ground.
These suits usually involve a 1983 claim and a claim under state law, correct?
Very often they do, Your Honor.
And so that's why it would be helpful to perhaps compare and contrast or parallel the test for qualified immunity to 1983 claims?
Yes, Your Honor. I think this could have been a 1983 claim.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Yes, please, the court. Mr. Larry Benn.
May it please the court, my name is Larry Zinn, Fidel Rodriguez, and I represent Henry Valadez. This is a case in which the jury found not only negligence, but gross negligence, a conscious indifference, found that there was an intentional causing of bodily injury and that there was a false imprisonment, and they found that these acts were done not only with a conscious indifference, but also with malice. They also found that the officer did not act, among other things, in good faith. So the question is whether the officer, as a matter of law, is entitled to immunity for these acts. And I suppose by implication, whether officers who across the state who commit these acts and are found guilty and the evidence supports such findings, whether they are also entitled to immunity as a matter of law for these acts. While I don't agree with the Court of Appeals finding with regard to the discretionary function, because I don't believe that officers have the discretion to arrest folks without probable cause or to use excessive force. If they do, then that is something that is even beyond the U.S. Constitution.
Let's focus.
Kind of discretion.
Mr. Zinn, let's focus on probable cause here. Are you saying that under the record in this case, the police officer did not have probable cause to make the arrest?
Yes. I'm saying that given the legal sufficiency standard and applying it to this case, that there is sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding that he was falsely imprisoned. Because the definition of false imprisonment that the jury was given, and in fact under the law, including our Texas Penal Code, is that somebody's willfully detained without their consent, without legal justification. Probable cause is an element of false imprisonment, and there's evidence to support that finding.
Okay, but you're saying that this finding of false imprisonment precludes as a matter of law, and probable cause to make the arrest in the first instance?
Well, it's a binding jury finding that a binding finding by the finder of fact that there was no such probable. If there's evidence to support that finding, then that's a binding fact finding upon this court under the legal sufficiency standard. And by the way, the jury's answer to that question was never challenged on appeal, either both in the Court of Appeals or in this court. The findings of malice have never been challenged in the Court of Appeals or in this court. The only findings that are being challenged here are with regard to the good faith finding. Raise a question to court whether official immunity is even available to a public official when there are findings of false imprisonment, assault, and malice. Those findings themselves negate the elements of an official immunity defense. In fact, was there even a need for the question to be submitted? We got a favorable finding. But did it even have to be submitted in this case, given the findings of the jury and the evidence to support it?
You're saying that the jury's implied finding of no probable cause in order to find that there was false imprisonment precludes this court from even reaching the issue of good faith? This seems to be what Justice Cornyn was asking the other side a while ago. If there is probable cause, do we even have to reach good faith? If they find there is no probable cause, do we have to reach good faith?
Yes, we've got separate acts here. It wasn't just a false arrest. There was also excessive force. Even if the arrest was lawful, he didn't have the right to use the force he did. And that's encompassed in the assault finding, and also in the negligence to some degree. So that there are really two separate acts here. There's the false arrest, and then there's the use of excessive force. And we got favorable findings on both, encompassed in the assault false imprisonment findings. Not only did they find that, but they found that these acts were done with malice.
Can't have good faith in a malicious situation, can you?
It's pretty hard. There's an old line of Texas cases, and I go back to the prior century, that talk of false imprisonment causes of action not allowing a good faith defense. And it's interesting, Justice Cornyn, you mentioned that the 1983 is a place to look for, because there are often in 1983 actions we have state pendant claims on false imprisonment or assault or other such actions. The Fifth Circuit has looked at that, and there's a case, for example, at 619 Federal 2nd at 527 at Dowhit v. Jones, in which the jury found favorable to the arresting officer on the good faith issue under 1983, yet the Fifth Circuit affirmed the findings as to false imprisonment. And the reason they said that was relying on the state Texas common law, that the good faith defense is not available in a state Texas common law action false imprisonment.
Mr. Zinn, if there are such cases relevant from an earlier time in Texas, I don't see them in your brief.
Oh, they're not there, Your Honor.
Well, if they are relevant to this, I would hope that you would promptly submit at least a letter brief advising us of their applicability and giving us the citation.
I will, Your Honor. There is a more recent line of federal Fifth Circuit cases which speak to those. But if you look at the elements of false imprisonment, it seems that without even with the malice binding, that the elements of false imprisonment negate the elements of official immunity, because in order to be found guilty,
of false imprisonment, you must act without legal authority. And if you don't have legal authority, how can you have official immunity? And the same thing is true in assault. If a citizen gets a common law finding on assault, which is an intentional, knowing, or reckless causing of bodily injury, doesn't that also, as a matter of law, negate any finding of good faith or discretionary act?
If the judgment in this case is based on negligence, isn't it?
That is what the judgment recites.
Isn't that a disregarding of the findings of intentional conduct?
Well, the actual judgment, that's in the preamble to the judgment. The actual rendering is just for an amount of money. And there's a line of Texas cases that say that what the judge says before he gets to the rendering is not dispositive.
So is this an intentional, the judgment then is based on the findings of intentional torts?
It's dependent on all three, because the jury made findings and damages the same in all three. It's, in all honesty, it was added for purposes of indemnity purposes. So the next case, unfortunately.
Coming back to your assault argument, it seems that proves too much. What an arresting officer would do to someone, if done by someone else, would be an assault. Doesn't the fact that the officer is an officer cloak him from immunity for that?
For purposes of excessive force, he's got access to other defenses. For example, in a shootout, and let's say the citizen is hurt, obviously there's, in a sense, been an assault. An intentional causing of bodily injury, but he's got a defense.
But if he just
there.
Handcuffs you, that's an intentional cause of bodily injury.
Yes, it could be.
If he did it to me, it would be an assault.
But the officer has access to another defense, and that is justifiable force, which is, for example, defined in the Penal Code. It could be in terms of self-defense. It could be in terms of defense to others. The concept of justifiable force is defined in Chapter 9 of the Penal Code. He has access to those defenses. I assume that that's a separate defense than from what we're talking about in terms of official immunity. He's got access to that defense in an assault case.
Why should he have access to official immunity? He is acting not as an ordinary citizen, but as a police officer.
But whether he is a police officer or an ordinary citizen, no one has a right in our country to use unreasonable force, excessive force, unnecessary force.
But he has the right to seize someone under some circumstances that no one else has.
He can act within reason. If he goes beyond that limit, he has lost his immunity.
Well, then, in other words, you're saying that assault for a police officer is different from assault for someone else.
A police officer has access to more defenses, yes.
Apart from his defenses, just looking at the cause of action, laying aside for a moment the defenses, can you prove a police officer liable for assault under the same circumstances that you could for an ordinary person?
Yes. And what separates the police officer from the ordinary citizen in that kind of case is that he or she has more defenses available to them. The citizen doesn't have an official immunity defense available to him. They also don't have as much room in terms of justifiable force. An ordinary citizen does have certain self-defense rights, but they are not as broad as those of the officer. If the court is determined to define good faith in this case, and is determined to look to U.S. Supreme Court precedent to do it, I would urge the court to continue to look at the line of the cases it has looked at, which is Woodby Strickland, and those line of cases. And the reason I would, as opposed to some of the more recent cases, such as Anderson v. Crichton or Harlow v. Fitzgerald, for the reason that Woodby Strickland, while not a codification of the common law, comes closer than some of the later versions of the U.S. Supreme Court in terms of trying to delineate the common law
in terms of a, in bring it to a case on immunity, even in a statutory action like 1983. You know, the Supreme Court is working with different policies than this court would be in determining Texas common law actions as opposed to a statutory 1983 action. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about things such as federalism and even, I'll put it bluntly, docket control, which was actually mentioned by the court because they felt that there was an explosion of 1983 cases and they just wanted to cut them down. We don't have an explosion of Texas common law actions. These actions have been around since this court's been around. These are long-established actions. The elements haven't changed in over a century in terms of false imprisonment and assault. And so when you look at this U.S. Supreme Court precedent, I think it's important to recognize that there are different policy arguments involved and that many of the arguments of and the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court recently do not speak to the policies which this court would be concerned with in Texas common law actions.
You urge us to adhere to the Supreme Court authority that Justice Cornyn relied on in his concurrence in the Travis against City of Mesquite case if we deal with that issue.
I'll put it this way. If you're determined to look to U.S. Supreme Court precedent, that makes the most sense. It would be Strickland. And this dichotomy of subjective and objective findings. I would only add one other thing with regard to the objective definition of good faith. There is a danger in forcing the plaintiff to prove two things on the same issue because, or if you put it another way, you may be giving the public official two bites of the apple. The reason is this. If you define good faith objectively as a certain form of reasonableness, isn't that also encompassed in the decisions that the jury makes and that the court makes in terms of duty and proximate cause and in terms of negligence? For example, in the City of Mesquite case, the majority opinion spoke of proximate cause and the various policy arguments that are involved in determining whether legally we're going to require police officers to foresee these kinds of events. But isn't that really the same thing that's going on in your objective test of good faith? The same weighing of the same policy arguments. And there's a danger, I think, of forcing the citizen to prove the same thing twice if you involve that same kind of policy, because after all, if the public official gets a favorable finding on either one of those questions, they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
But you're not suggesting that it's the plaintiff's burden to disprove official immunity. It's remained the affirmative defense of the officer, does it not?
Yes.
But you're saying there's some overlap between...
Yes. And really what we're talking about in defining official immunity is really defining policy. And I think that's why there's so much confusion in the law right now among all the different courts about what it means, because each case presents different policy arguments. There's not one single test.
Mr.
The policy Bailey, arguments...
On that deal about good faith, if one of the elements of official immunity is acting in the course and scope of their function, and two, that is discretionary, then if we say that good faith, this discretionary function within the course and scope of your authority has to be exercised in good faith, do we not say that, say, selective enforcement, the law enforcement agencies realize they can't solve every crime, they can't solve every cause of action, and so they're just going to go after the drug kingpins and not all of the little mules out there making these deliveries, as they call them. And then someone gets arrested as coming across the border carrying drugs, and they claim selective enforcement. You've got to prove that you arrested me in the scope and authority, which concede you did, that it was a discretionary function, conceding that it was, but you exercised the discretion contrary to your stated policy of going after kingpins because you've come after little old me, and that's not in good faith. Don't we run into the problem if good faith is an element of the official immunity of claim of selective enforcement as a defense, I mean,
to rob a police officer who's otherwise in course of scope, otherwise exercising discretion, losing official immunity, not because they beat up on the person, but simply because they chose to arrest this person as opposed to some other person?
No, I don't think that's a problem. Because an investigating officer is going to have liability, not just if they just make a, by the way, that's a policy decision probably being made by higher-ups to go after certain kinds of folks. But, for example, the Linnell Jeter case, which was the case of the black man who was wrongfully convicted of the aggravated robbery. The Fifth Circuit affirmed the summary judgment as to the city, the district attorney, and the county, and the entities involved. They, however, reversed it for trial with regard to the investigating officer, because the evidence in that case showed that not just was the investigating officer simply making a decision that I'm going to investigate these little aggravated robberies more than the Brinks truck hits. He made it, he when faced with evidence that Linnell Jeter was innocent, he ignored it, and in fact showed bad faith in making that decision. The decision to investigate a particular matter for a particular person simply on the grounds of, without regard to the specifics of the case in that sense, is a protected act. But if that investigating officer selects an individual and when faced with evidence of innocence chooses to proceed against that individual, and an overwhelming bit of evidence of innocence, then there may well be a justiciable issue. After all, if in the person, the mule who's arrested, there's no illegal arrest. There's no cause of action. While official immunity may not apply, what cause of action is there for the citizen?
I think you've answered my question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, the defense of official immunity was an affirmative defense that you asserted in this case.
Yes, sir.
And like every other affirmative defense in the state of Texas, the burden on showing that is yours.
It is, Your Honor.
And doesn't that then, if an element of that official immunity defense is proving subjective good faith, that's your responsibility to prove it, not the plaintiff's to prove a lack of good faith.
That's how I understand it in state law, Your Honor.
And if there's been a jury finding of gross negligence and malice, why should a police officer under those circumstances be immunized from harming the citizen?
I think the finding of gross negligence and malice in this case, or in the hypothetical case, might not very well be binding on the element of good faith, because the instructions to be given to the jury in defining those terms are going to be different. And that would be the best answer I can give to you on that.
Hasn't our discussion, though, of gross negligence talked about some things that come pretty close to good faith?
Now, I can't say that there's a black and white distinction. There's certainly some concern when you have a finding of gross negligence. What would you do with, I'm sorry, I shouldn't ask you a question, but rhetorically, what should be done with a jury finding of good faith, also in a verdict where there's no finding of good faith, did I say it right, good faith and malice or something like that. In this case, the court did not incorporate the jury verdict in its judgment. In this case, while it's not expressed in the record that the court considered the 301 motion, I think it's only reasonably inferred because the court did something that it could only do in response to the 301 motion, which was on file with it for 5 or 6 months. That is, it disregarded at least part of that jury finding. Now, with a 10-2 finding on conjunctive submission of good faith, discretion, and course and scope, how can we tell what the jurors found?
I'm not sure I'm clear on that last part. What is there in this record that establishes that the trial court disregarded a portion of the jury verdict.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. The motion, the 301 motion was there. The court could, as I understand the law, disregard immaterial findings, which my first position is, yes, it was an immaterial finding because those elements are established already as a matter of law. But in the event that's not so, then the court, in disregarding the course and scope of employment and putting that into the judgment, contrary to what the jury said, the only authority for the court to do that would be on the 301 motion, as I understand it. It can't do it on its own unless it's an immaterial finding.
Do we have, what was that done at a hearing that was, is that the first question, was it at a hearing?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not expressly shown in the record. The settings were done by agreement. I can see a better way to do that in the future, I guess, is not to agree to settings with opposing counsel, but that runs contrary to what we're trying to get at here. But I think you can infer it if you want to.
This event occurred at a hearing with the trial judge, with both of you present. We just don't have a transcript of what took place there.
I'll represent to the court there were several hearings. Mm-hmm. Some discussion. Although it's not in the record, the matter he interjected about indemnity was certainly being considered. The court was not engaged in this. I'll give the court back time. Thank you for allowing us to be here.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's argument. The foregoing three causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Thank you.